Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, June 30th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back Jeremy Hurst. Jeremy is the Game Management Section Head for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. And joining Jeremy today, Jordan Youngman, a wildlife biologist in the DEC's Division of Fish and Wildlife Land Management Section. You want to get a call in about wildlife things in your backyard or your neighborhood? 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Jeremy Hurst, Jordan Youngman, and your wildlife questions coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're discussing wildlife today, and we welcome back Jeremy Hurst, Game Management Section Head for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. He facilitates research, outreach, and management planning for New York's big game, small game, mid-sized game, fur-bearing wildlife. Joining Jeremy today is Jordan Youngman, a wildlife biologist in the DEC's Division of Fish and Wildlife Land Management. He works on habitat management across New York's wildlife management areas, as well as the DEC's prescribed fire program. And that's a whole show in itself. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Jeremy Hurst, how you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for having us.
What's happening over in the department?
Oh, it's always a fun time in the spring because you see new wildlife.
Yeah.
And so it's a joy to see new fawns wandering about, stepping behind their mothers. It's see a pile of turkey poults following behind the turkey hen. It's a nice time of year.
I know we've talked about this before, but when the fawns are out, and we saw this in our backyard last week or week before, the mother is nowhere to be seen. That's normal, right?
It is normal. I mean, sometimes you'll see a doe cross the road and then a fawn come after or two fawns after. But often if you see a fawn on the edge of the field or on the edge of somebody's backyard, you may not see the doe anywhere near. And that's typical. That's actually a survival benefit for the fawns, not to attract predators. And so the doe will just leave that fawn sit, come back and nurse every once in a while.
But they can barely walk. I mean, is it safe for the fawn to be out there? There are predators out there.
They're vulnerable for sure, and particularly those first couple of hours when they're real wobbly-legged. But they actually recover pretty quick and start being able to be mobile in a couple of days and can follow thereafter. They can probably outrun a fox in a couple of days.
Jordan Youngman is also with us today. You haven't been on this show before, right?
First time. Happy to be here.
Hey, we'll turn your mic on. It'll be even better. Hang on. Hey, Michael. Michael, can you turn on Jordan's microphone? Okay. Welcome to the show. This is how first-timer usually, we call it hazing.
Yeah,
now you're in.
Happy to be here.
Good to have you here. So what do you do at the DEC?
So I'm in the land management section right there in the Bureau of Wildlife, same as Jeremy. And our section works on habitat management primarily across our WMA system, so Wildlife Management Area System. And so this is habitat management specifically for wildlife. And then my job in particular is I was hired on after the 2022 Environmental Bond Act. And so I do more restoration work. Some of that has to do with using Bond Act funds for restoration.
Restoration of habitat?
Habitat.
And
yeah.
How do you go about doing that? Give me an example.
Oh, there are many ways to do that. So the one example is we help facilitate a grant program through the Division of Water's WQIP program. And so we administer money for restoration of wetland and riparian corridor habitat. So that's kind of fish and wildlife habitat in wetlands and riparian corridors. And the other component I work on is restoration using prescribed fire as a means of restoring and rejuvenating ecosystems.
I find that the science, if it isn't a science unto itself, of prescribed fire to be so interesting.
Incredibly fascinating.
There's so much that needs to be done right. And I guess there's a lot that could go wrong. We had folks from the Albany Pine Bush on, and I got to tell you something. I learned so much about prescribed fire. When is too much? That's the question.
Well, I think we're figuring that out for the Northeast. It's kind of a funny time to be in doing this work here in the Northeast, because for a long time there was this perception that prescribed fire or fire historically wasn't really an active disturbance on our landscape. And I mean, Albany Pine Bush is a great example of realizing the need for prescribed fire and then carefully figuring out how much is the appropriate amount. I think, you know, I listened to Neil come and talk with you.
He was awesome.
Yeah, he was a wonderful guy and so incredibly good at what he does. And he talked about how there's no roadmap. So you're kind of figuring it out as we go. And so part of the process that we're in is identifying places that need fire, and then through kind of adaptive management, figuring out how much fire is the appropriate amount. And there's plenty of examples in other parts of the country to kind of look to figure that out.
Now, you know, the impression I got from talking to Neil, and it might be totally wrong, is that New York really seems to do it well, but there are parts of this country where it's not, prescribed fire is not done as well. Wrong or right?
I think there are parts of the country that have a long history of using prescribed fire very effectively. So I spent almost a decade getting educated down in the Southeast, and that's an area of the country that uses prescribed fire often and well to manage for wildlife habitat. I think the concern is you're going to use it in places or use it in ways where you might have negative effects. And that's certainly one part of it. The other part of it is not using it in places that need it. And so I think looking towards the Northeast, and as we realize the need that we have, trying to use prescribed fire to kind of tackle that second component where there's the need and we don't have it.
I think one of the fascinating things that in our conversation, Jordan, there are areas in New York where you know there's fire history. Mm. Pine Bush is a good example. But there's other areas that we wouldn't typically think about the fire history. But as you are digging into the literature and learning more about landscape in New York, you're finding new areas that were kind of out of our perspective for prescribed fire.
Yeah. And again, I think the shifting paradigm that we're under, you know, in our state and in the Northeast, where there's really exciting work being done across the region, looking back at historical records, so documentation of indigenous land use practices, descriptions of early European settlers describing landscapes, and realizing that actually large portions of the Northeast experienced frequent fire as a disturbance, and it was almost entirely purposeful fire placed in the landscape by indigenous.
And I remember Neil talking about that. Yeah. It's amazing the knowledge that these people had 1,000 years ago or more. It's incredible, without the benefit of the so-called science that we have today. Is there federal oversight for prescribed fires, or is this state by state, region by region?
Typically state by state, region by region. So in New York State, the DEC regulates prescribed fire both on DEC lands and non-DEC lands.
The number to call here if you have a wildlife question for our guests today, Jordan Youngman and Jeremy Hurst, is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get to the email bag in a moment. But the newsroom is abuzz. All the bears are out. There's a lot of bear sightings. You guys give me an update on that.
Yeah, we have had a lot of bear sightings this spring so far. And it's not really that atypical. This is a time when people are seeing bears, and bears are out and about and active and sometimes getting into places where they create challenges for people. Maybe a little bit more so this year than last, and so that's a bit of a difference. But the key is it's our responsibility to keep our places clean and not make them attractive for bears, and that can reduce the potential for conflicts.
And they come out primarily in the day or in the night, or does it matter?
Well, bears are largely crepuscular, going to be active more in the morning and the evening, but they can be active at any time of day, and if there's food available, they may find it.
Why do you think there are more this year?
You know, it's just a cyclical pattern that we see. There is a pulse in cub productivity every other year, and so the population kind of ebbs and flows on a biannual basis. And so this year, we've got a lot of bears, and we have some dry conditions right now that makes some of the natural foods a little bit less palatable and desirable for bears. And if people still have bird feeders up and haven't started the practice of making sure their garbage is protected, that creates some opportunities for bears.
And bears are omnivores.
They are.
They'll eat anything. Well, they generally around here will not attack people, or am I wrong?
Well, bears are always a potential risk, and so there's caution that's justified anytime that we're around a bear. But no, interactions with humans are very, very rare, and generally bears will run away from people.
All right, this is an email from Rich. Here's a simple question for your representatives. Is it legal for a homeowner to trap a groundhog and release it at some location miles away, or is that something that could only be done by a licensed pest control worker? Aha!
So the answer is yes and no. It is legal for a homeowner that's experiencing damage from a groundhog to trap the groundhog, but it is not legal for them to take it somewhere else and release it.
So what do you do?
And so the disposition of that animal has to be a lethal removal. So the homeowner has to arrange a way to kill that animal and then to bury it, dispose of it. And that can be done depending on location with a firearm. It can be done in a variety of different ways. If a homeowner is not comfortable doing that, there is opportunity to call a nuisance wildlife control operator who could take care of it for them.
You know, we did the gardening show, I don't know, last week or something, and this topic came up again. And they said, well, if you got the holes in the ground, put some used cat litter in there. You guys have any experience with that?
I don't have any experience with that.
I don't.
No?
No.
Why are you laughing? Is it a ridiculous idea?
Well, as an owner of cats, that would keep me away, but I don't know if it keep a groundhog away.
All right, our number here is 800-348-2551. We'll get to your calls in a moment here. Jeremy Hurst and Jordan Youngman with us from the New York DEC. We'll be back. Hey there, if you are a fan of Cars with Gordon Fricke on this program, you might want to listen to this. July 28th at the Saratoga Auto Museum, we're going to be there live and record a live show right there, answer your automotive questions. We'll have actually a full panel this time. Don McCabe, who works with Gordon, will be there. And also car enthusiast Philip Morris will be with us. It's going to be a fun show. And if you've never been to the Saratoga Auto Museum, it's really cool. You can find out tickets, you can find out information and find out about tickets at wamc.org/on the road. I believe it's live as we speak. If not, I'm in a lot of trouble. It's live July 28th, Saratoga Auto Museum. We'll do a live recording. You can find out more at wamc.org/on the road. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, and the number here is 800-348-2551. We're joined by Jeremy Hurst and Jordan Youngman from the New York State DEC. One more quick email before we go to the phones, and this is from Marie in Dalton, Mass. What are good career opportunities in working with wildlife or in relation to conservation and ecology? My priority is to be outside often. What schooling would you recommend? And that's from Marie in Dalton, Mass.
That's a great question. There are a lot of different opportunities. You could always be a biologist like Jeremy or I, and that usually is a degree in biology or environmental studies, an undergrad degree, and then oftentimes a master's degree doing some kind of thesis work studying wildlife biology.
Yeah,
that'd be one option. Kind of parks ranger job opportunities.
I think everybody thinks we're
everybody
park rangers.
That's exactly right. Everybody thinks we're park rangers or that we're running around catching wildlife with our bare hands. And
neither are true. Now, to be fair, Jeremy does that a lot anyway for fun, right?
On weekends.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right.
All right, the number here is 800-348-2551. We begin in Windsor, Massachusetts. Jack, you're up. Go ahead.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Sure, go ahead.
Awesome. This is kind of a two-part question, but I have a acre-sized pond. It's about 16 feet deep, beautiful, but I have been visited by otters, and they have decimated the little bit of fish population I had in there, as well as my prized large mussels. You know, they're like huge mussels.
Okay.
That filter the water. And I was wondering how, or if there's anything that deter otters. And second part of the question is, what do you think would be best to stock the pond since it's pretty much empty now? and how to go about doing it.
Okay.
Well, Jack, that's actually a fun problem to have. I would love to have a pond with an otter.
Oh, they're so cute.
Yeah, it's a good trade-off for what you're losing, I suspect. But I think first I'd say, because you're in Massachusetts, I'm not familiar with what Massachusetts Wildlife authorizes and what they allow. And so I would have you start by contacting their office. And you may need a permit, whether that be for dealing with the otter or restocking your pond. You should connect with them for whatever legalities there are in that. In terms of how you might deal with the otter, though, I would say it's there for food. And so if it fully depletes your pond, it's not going to stay around much longer.
Oh, that's a good point.
Which, of course, that'd be a bummer, both because you don't have anything left in the pond and you lose the otter. I don't know if, given the size of your pond, that you'll be able to maintain both without some regular supplemental addition of food to the pond. But again, I'd start with Mass Wildlife. Yeah, make sure you get some good pictures there before he leaves, though.
Ah. I got some great videos.
Oh, good. Hey, thanks a lot, Jack. Appreciate the call. 800-348-2551. That's the number if you have a wildlife question for Jeremy Hurst and or Jordan Youngman. That's if Jeremy lets Jordan speak, and I'm not sure. He's very new. Let's go to Jerry in Milan, New York. Jerry, you're on.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. Welcome.
Yes. I'm a former resident, but I do have a house here in Milan, and I come back and forth to, from Florida. And the game laws are a lot more liberal in Florida. Like, right off the bat, you can kill 3 bucks and 2 does. And I know a few years ago around this area, there was a deer die-off from some kind of virus. And it was just dead deer all over the place. And I'm assuming the reason that was there wasn't enough deer taken by hunters, and Mother Nature kicks in and, the harsh way to, cut down the deer population. So that, and I would like to come up here and hunt as a non-resident. Is there any, updates on being more liberal with permits to take deer?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, good question, Jerry. So let me back up. And you mentioned the deer disease that happened a couple years ago. There was a viral disease that affected deer in parts of the Hudson Valley several years ago. It's been 4 or 5 years now since we've had an outbreak. It's called epizootic hemorrhagic disease. It's a disease or a virus carried by a little tiny biting midge that infects deer and has really devastating impacts on individual deer. And when there is a concentrated outbreak in a local area, it can have a pretty substantial impact on the deer population in that local area. But local is the key factor there. Is it's not generally a widespread issue. It's actually not really that much of a density dependence issue either, where you have a high deer population that puts them more at risk. It's a factor of the midge being present and the midge impacting these deer. Of course, if you have a small deer population, you may have lesser impact, but it's not necessarily a result of other management factors. The population that was affected in the Hudson Valley a couple years ago seems to have rebounded quite well. So we were conservative in the years after that in how we managed deer there, allowed the population to regrow to an appropriate level. In one way, it was actually helpful because the deer population there was too high to begin with. And so when we lost some deer, it was a bad way for the deer to go, but it was helpful ecologically. And so when we allowed the population to grow, we didn't want it to grow too far. And so we've been managing it that way. Now, are we making changes this year? Absolutely. We've got a situation across a lot of the state where we have too many deer. Not everywhere, but certainly broad swaths of the state, we've got too many deer, and we need to make some substantial changes. And so there's going to be a few things happening different this year. We're going to make a bunch of areas with permits more available for hunters. In fact, there's going to be probably 20-some management units across the state where we'll have essentially unlimited opportunity for doe tags. And the doe tags are important because that's the segment of the population that adjusts the overall number. If we can remove adult female deer, we can impact the population growth so it can be reduced. It can stay stable when that's necessary. And so hunters will be able to get tags. If they are successful, they can get replacement tags. And we want to make successful hunters more successful. Elsewhere and across the rest of the state, we're establishing something we're calling an Earn a Second Buck program. For years, hunters have had the opportunity to take 2 antler deer, 2 bucks every year if they hunted across multiple seasons. We're changing that practice where now they'll still be able to get 2 bucks, but they'll have to shoot an antlerless deer first. And the reason for this is we have way too many hunters that choose not to shoot antlerless deer, or you know, maybe by the choices they're making, focusing on bucks, are opting out from taking antlers deer. We want to make sure that hunters have that emphasis on taking antlers deer. Population control is a primary reason why we do deer management. We need to manage the population to benefit all of New Yorkers, not just hunters.
Jerry, you want to follow up very quickly?
Yeah, like I say, it looks like you guys are starting to make some progress, but, you know, like in Georgia, they, and it's hard to believe, but I mean, I read the regulations and I have friends that hunt there. You can take 10 does a year. I mean, that seems unbelievable, but I guess that's, you can't take 10 bucks a year. It's probably 3 or 4, but you can take 10 does a year. I mean, that's, you know, like I say, you know, it's hard to believe. Now, will these new rules apply to these permits for like non-residents like myself?
Yeah, they'll be both for residents and non-residents, and you'll see this in our hunting regulations guide that comes out later this summer.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Jordan Youngman, you said you spent a good amount of time in the southeastern U.S.
I did.
And so...
Hunted multiple seasons in Georgia when I was down there for my PhD. So,
yeah.
He's absolutely right. 10 does and $2 at the time, if I remember correctly.
And how many people you think take more than two?
There's not a lot of them. And yeah. So those bag limits are to some degree accounting for that. Factors.
Yeah, it's interesting. Across the country, there are a lot of states that have larger bag limits than we do. And of course, now in parts of the state, we're making very large bag limits. But overall, the harvest rate of deer, it's relatively few hunters take one deer to begin with, and an exceptionally few hunters take two or three deer. And so we're looking at on the maybe 15% of hunters are taking two or more deer.
Okay, let's go to Naomi, who is on the thruway, began in Prattsville, but has been on hold so long, we don't even know where she is now. Naomi, where are you?
That's very funny. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually on Route 23, going up past Cairo, not Cairo.
Yeah.
Nice show. Glad you're doing this show. I have a really kind of weird question that I've been wondering about for a really long time. So I live up in the mountains above Windham Mountain, and a lot of it are second homes for people from the city. And this usually what happens is the guys come up hunting, and then they bring their wives, and the wives are scared to death because I don't mean to be, you know, classist, but they're scared to death of the dark because there are no streetlights where we live.
Yeah.
And there are lots of bear, and there used to be, and I say used to be in capital letters, a ton of coyotes. And I've always had dogs, and one of our dogs, Max, who is a yellow lab, would sit at the end of the driveway, and he would howl, and the coyotes would sing back to him. And then one weekend we were away and he was in the kennel and he got really, really sick, really sick. And I drove back from Maine and got him, and they told me that they thought he had been poisoned. And I actually took him to the vet and he died. It was really awful. But the vet told me that he actually had been poisoned, and that he had heard, and so had I, that the state was poisoning off the coyotes.
Huh.
So I'm just wondering if that really was and continues to be the case, because I haven't seen a coyote or heard a coyote up where we live in over 5 years.
Okay.
Which is really amazing.
All right, fellas, what's the truth of this?
Truth of it is that, no, it's not legal to poison coyotes. It's not legal for us to allow other people to poison coyotes, and we don't do it ourselves. Aside from the rumor, you know, it's interesting that you haven't heard any coyotes, because there shouldn't be any specific reason why that might be the case. Coyotes are ubiquitous across
the
state.
They're like gone.
And,
and
so what we really see with coyotes is that they're present when their food are present. And so there'll be cycles in some of the small game populations. And if there are not as many rabbits or grouse, if there's not as many woodchucks in the area, you'll see some changes.
There are tons of woodchucks and, and moles and not tons of rabbits, but there are rabbits. Anyway, I'm glad to hear that. I don't know what happened. I mean, it was awful. He was howling.
Yeah,
like
sorry to hear about that loss.
I love hearing it too. Yeah, thank you, Naomi. Appreciate the call. Yeah, when I was a kid, I grew up around here. You could always hear them. If a fire whistle went off, they would all start yowling, and it was tremendous. But I haven't heard that in a long time.
Yeah. Well, they are also, I mean, in relation to their prey, habitat dependent. So if you have habitat that supports small mammals, you're going to have more coyotes. And, you know, the other thing to remember is coyotes kind of moved into New York over the last how many decades, you know, since the 50s. And oftentimes with animal populations, as they colonize an area, they kind of overshoot their carrying capacity.
Yeah.
And so potentially what we're seeing across many states as coyotes have kind of moved into the eastern United States is that initial pulse of the population is oftentimes a lot higher than what ends up kind of stabilizing over time.
It's Wildlife Today with Jeremy Hurst and Jordan Youngman from the New York State DEC. This email at voxpop@wamc.org is from Fran in Albany. Subject heading, kill, kill, kill. I heard on the bird show to kill the sparrows, and now I hear DEC say trap and kill. Where is our humanity these days? I have lots of all sorts of wildlife where I live in the country, and I'd never think of killing any of them. Nature can take care of itself, and homeowners are so fanatic about having their property look so perfect that they lose their sense of what is right and wrong, in my opinion, and I'll bet lots of other folks would agree. There certainly are pests, and sometimes they cause frustration, but never anger enough to kill them. Why? We can learn a lot from these wonderful creatures. We are now watching with wonder our beautiful newborn fawns, some of them twins. Can't we think of more intelligent and acceptable ways to live with wildlife? They were here before us and will probably inherit the land again when man self-destructs each other. And that's from Fran in Albany. Gentlemen.
Fran, thanks so much for your question. And explaining that all, it's a great perspective that we need to keep in mind, because as wildlife biologists, we got into this field because we love wildlife, as
right.
you do. And so we appreciate living wildlife and are so grateful that we have the opportunity to study them, to watch them, and to help manage their populations. But what you've described is really a values issue, and we have these conflicting values that wildlife create because we, on one hand, really appreciate their presence, appreciate knowing that they're here and that their populations are thriving, and we work hard to make sure that that can stay that way. But we also know that wildlife creates some conflicts, and sometimes that's a groundhog burrowing underneath somebody's porch and undermining the foundation, or it is a fox that's killing chickens, or it is a deer population that is so large that it's overgrazing the forest and creating some shifts in the ecosystem that are detrimental to the sustainability of forest. And so those conflicts are what need to be addressed. And while we as managers often and generally think about ways that we can do that in non-lethal approaches, lethal approaches are often the conclusion after non-lethal approaches are not successful. And so in some cases, we jump right to lethal control because that's the most expeditious. In other cases, when we're talking about like deer hunting, for say, we're talking about a regulated activity that gives us the ability to manage deer populations across the breadth of the state while we deal with specific instances with homeowners or landowners that may or may not involve lethal control.
You want to jump in there, Jordan?
No, I mean, Jeremy, you covered it very well. I think, you know, again, understanding these different values and, you know, part of our job as biologists for the state is to try to, as best we can, address the different value systems of the New Yorkers that we serve. And so sometimes works in certain ways for one person and different ways for somebody else.
Well, Fran, thank you for that email. Appreciate it very much. The number here is 800-348-2551. Let's get one more before the next break. We'll go to Gary in Schenectady, New York. Gary, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is my very favorite Vox Pop. I was blessed years ago in hiking in the Adirondacks, and Buck Mountain to be exact, to be sitting quietly on a rock and to have a fisher come loping down the trail towards me close enough that I could finally see his face and know he certainly was a weasel and before he took off on me. I've learned a lot about them since. But I'm interested in another large animal that may be related. I know in northern New York we have martens. Can you tell me more about martens? Are they related at all to fishers, or what are they if they're not weasels like fishers are? And tell me a little more about their lifestyle, what they eat and things like that. Okay, thank you.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Gary.
I can start, but I'm going to exhaust the level of expertise I have. So, they're both weasels. A Martin is going to be smaller. It's going to not be that dark chocolate brown that a Fisher is. They have kind of cute little pointy ears that are pretty distinctive to them, as opposed to, I guess, any of the other weasels here in New York State.
Okay.
And you're right, there's a geographic, I mean, they overlap geographically, but we're not finding Martins down into the southern parts of the state.
Yeah, Martins are more restricted to the Adirondacks and specifically some of the high peaks areas of the Adirondacks. Martin are about the size of your forearm in terms of the girth of your forearm. That's a good way to think about that, whereas a Fisher is maybe about the size of a house cat, a little bit bigger at times. And so their diet doesn't necessarily overlap perfectly, but more it's that geographic distinction that we have.
All right, Gary, thank you very much for the call. We got to take a break here. 800-348-2551. That's the number. 800-348-2551. We'll check the email bag and then hit the phones again after this. Clifford Brown there on the trumpet with Sonny Rollins on the saxophone. Pent Up House here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Wildlife Today with Jordan Youngman and Jeremy Hurst. Before we get to the email bag, how about a quick update on Snapshot New York?
Sure. So Snapshot New York is a program that we, our Bureau of Wildlife, in conjunction with Cornell University, have been piloting this last 2 years. It's an opportunity for the public to get involved, to witness what's happening in your backyard or in the wooded property that you own, and it involves cameras. We use digital trail cameras that we place in the woods and allow that sort of passive monitoring of what's happening. And the cameras take pictures of whatever walks by, and so we'll learn what is present throughout the state. By coupling work that our staff are doing, we've got about 1,000 cameras that our staff run across the state and probably 800 or so that are being used by the public right now. It allows us to look at the distribution of wildlife, the abundance of wildlife in different parts of the state, and to, over time, also get information about the sex ratios and the adult small and juvenile ratios. We'll get more information about wildlife. And it's a cool way for landowners to learn more about what's happening in their woods. And so Snapshot gives an opportunity for landowners to actually participate by selecting the area that they're in, using either their own personal trail camera or to rent one from us. I should say not rent, but borrow one from us that they can place out on their property and participate in the program.
Now, have you been watching any of the results? Have you been taking a look?
So we have millions of images already. And there are really some cool images. These are just still images, not videos, but you can see pictures of black bears, pictures of coyotes, pictures of marten and fisher and fox and deer. Of course,
mountain lions.
We have not seen mountain lion.
Bigfoot?
No Bigfoot.
Darn it. Okay.
But maybe some people posing.
Now that would be funny.
So check it out. It's I'm not remembering if it's snapshot.org, snapshotny.org, or snapshotny.com. But search Snapshot NY, New York DEC, and you'll find it.
Okay, fair enough. Now, listen, this whole kitty litter business is really, it has generated a lot of emails. So here we go. Hey, this is the way it is, Jordan. You'll get used to it, man. Ellen writes in, kitty litter method. I have not found it to be helpful to add used kitty litter to groundhog holes, unfortunately. And then we have Joni checking in. Joni says, when I was a hippie in the woods in the previous century, I was told that the resident groundhogs were repelled by poop, but I had a big family of them living under my outhouse, apparently quite comfortable with it. Now maybe cats produce something less hospitable, but I would not count on it. Just saying. And that's Joni, north of the Quabbin now.
Yeah. So, you know, cat litter is going to have that strong ammonia smell, right?
Yeah.
And ammonia is often used as a deterrent for wildlife that are attracted to different odors. And so I guess I wouldn't put it past being somewhat effective. What happens with these groundhog dens, though, is that they'll end up having urine and feces and their own sort of bio odors that are associated with that den. So even if it's vacant for a while, another groundhog might find it, not just because of the presence of the hole, but because of the residual odors. And so if the groundhogs are removed or leave that space, perhaps interrupting that odor trail may be enough to keep it from being reoccupied.
I mean, should you put a Febreze down there or something?
That might work.
Okay. Matt follows up on the woodchucks. What is the reasoning behind not allowing trapped woodchucks to be released elsewhere? What if it's a nice, large, wooded area, and that's where Matt?
Yeah, this is a state law, and so I would suspect when the lawmakers put this in place, it was because of the potential to move a problem to somebody else's backyard.
All right. Very quickly, two more, and then we'll get back to the phones. Jay writes in, how are we doing with invasive species here in the Northeast? What's currently on the watch list?
Oh, yeah, I mean, we're that's a constant battle that we face working in the land management section. In terms of what's on the watch list, I was just, as we were walking out the door there in central office, co-workers talking about swallowwort, which is kind of a viney species that is invasive. Things like Phragmites. So Phragmites is that kind of tall, frondy reed that you see as you drive highways. Once you see it, it's kind of hard to unsee it.
Is frondy an adjective? Because I've never heard of
frondy.
I've
waving. It's got a nice frond on top. It can be 10, 12 feet tall. And I've ruined things for my family as I've pointed it out, because once you see it, you realize it's kind of everywhere. It's a highly invasive reed that takes over wetlands.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. This one is about aquatic invasive species. This is from Paul in Rhinebeck. I live on a small lake in Rhinebeck. I've noticed some new vegetation. I'm concerned that it could be Eurasian milfoil. Can you advise me how to identify it?
I mean, the internet's a wonderful thing, so I'd go straight to the internet. There's also some good apps out there on your phone, so you can use something like the Seek app. I think there's an app called, are we allowed to just point out apps? So Seek app, I think Picture This is another good one that I've used and seen people use. And so those two options would probably get you pretty close.
All right, fair enough. All right, let's go back to the phones. We can go to the email bag later if we have time. Barbara has been waiting a while in Poughkeepsie. Hello, Barbara, you're on.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Sure thing.
Okay, so came home from vacation on Sunday to find a linden tree that we planted last fall totally covered with Japanese beetles. I mean, they'd eaten the leaves up to, you know, the top. They were very lacy looking, and there were so many on the tree that it looked like they were berries. We didn't find them in any other trees, but a walk in the woods behind us, which is just a little patch, there's a neighborhood behind us, there were tons of them there. What can we do?
Okay.
Oh, Barbara, Jordan and I both love linden trees, but neither of us really have a good idea about how to answer your question. This is outside our bailiwick. I know you can get commercial Japanese beetle traps, but that might not take care of what you're looking to do.
Yeah. Sounds like you got a problem.
Barbara, listen, the gardening show, in the summertime and in the spring and even early fall, we're two times a month, so they're coming up again. I would hold this. I think Fred Breglia and Greg Ward and everybody, they have some great ideas for you, okay?
Great. Thanks so much.
Appreciate the call. Let's go to Sharon, Connecticut. Catherine. Hello, Catherine.
Oh, hello. Thank you. What a great show.
Thank you.
It kind of helps me realize why we're working so hard to save the planet. Thank you.
Hmm. Well, I appreciate it. You got a question for the fellas?
I sure do.
Okay.
I have a little house up in the Adirondacks, and for probably 15 to 20 years, have been paying a lot to have just for vermin control. It's a clean house. I've lived up there more often than lately, so I've contained the mice through a service. It's become costly. I'm looking at that, and I'm certainly capable of putting out traps or poison or other things that are over the counter, but I don't want to kill the wildlife. You know, that typically my understanding is that the mice eat them and they run out, and I don't want deer to eat them or
birds. I mean,
whatever.
It gets in the food chain, and this is always my concern with poison. So what do you guys think about this?
Yes.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
So what do I do?
Well, Catherine, thanks for asking the question.
What should I do?
The risk with toxicants, poisons, is that the mice and other small mammals, chipmunks and such, will eat that and then run off and then die and either be consumed by birds of prey or larger mammal predator mammals. And we are actually seeing higher levels of toxicants in bobcats, in fisher, in otter, because of the consumption of animals that were then, you know, had eaten some bait or something like that. So what you can do is really probably the best way to protect your place is to identify the ways that the wildlife are getting inside the house, right? And so this can be really difficult on an old home, particularly a home that has a stone foundation or a log home. There may be numerous avenues of entry point, but if you can seal them up and exclude wildlife from your house, then the likelihood of having mouse troubles inside, of course, is going to be limited. That takes a lot of diligence, and it takes, honestly, there's a good technique that involves some phosphorescent powder on mice, and so you can use a Judas mouse.
What?
So I'll tell you a story. I lived in a small cabin in the Adirondacks during my graduate studies. Mouse problems like crazy all over the place. But we were wildlife students, and so I used a trap to capture a mouse, a live mouse, a special type of trap that doesn't kill them. And then I took it and shook it around in this bag of phosphorescent powder so it was pink. And then it left a trail everywhere it traveled.
Oh.
And I could go out at night with a black light and see the fluorescence of that powder in the trail of where the mouse went. And I did this for the intent of trying to locate how to
stop. Did you come up with that idea yourself?
However, what I learned was my house was so porous it would have been impossible for me to try to shut the mice out. So you may feel overwhelmed, but if your house is fairly tight and you can limit the number of spots that mice can get in, squirrels or chipmunks as well, you may have good success.
Okay.
Thank you, Catherine. Was that your idea? The phosphorescent mice?
No, I
really?
Stole it from somebody else. Another good story. I caught a mouse.
Okay.
And because I was a biologist, I put an ear tag in its ear, and I transported it a mile from my cabin.
Is that against the law?
No.
We were just talking about
this. Yeah, come on.
I don't think so.
All right.
Across a river, across a highway, and I placed it right on the doorstep of a house owned by Cornell.
Uh-huh.
That's a small tidbit. 2 days later, I caught the same mouse again. It came all the way back up.
Homeward bound.
Yeah. Long distance.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. That's the telephone number. It's Jeremy Hurst and Jordan Youngman from the New York State DEC. What a rollicking good time we're having. Lois in Lake Luzerne. Lois, go ahead. Hello.
Hi.
Can you
hear me?
More or less.
In the car.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I have a raccoon and squirrels that get on top of my garbage pail, which is full of bird seed. And occasionally I'll find red liquid. It looks like it might be urine. Is it a normal color for these species, or does somebody have a UTI?
Ouch. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what that
Thanks
could
for
be,
going
maybe.
There.
Yeah, well, it's a good question and a good observation. I think a lot of animals, their urine color will change depending on what they eat. Berries in particular can carry some coloration through to the urine. For these guys, I'm not sure what that might have been. But one thing to be careful of, particularly if you have raccoons, is you don't want to have any of that raccoon feces get on your hands. Raccoons can carry I don't remember if it's a protozoan, or some other parasite that can actually cause problems for us.
Okay.
So make sure you keep yourself clean as you're dealing with that.
Okay. Yeah, I'm careful and I usually hose it off. But yeah, but this raccoon comes every day. I mean, she has three babies, so
I know boy.
It's she.
Well, hopefully your garbage can is secured because bears will come to it too.
Yeah. Right.
Well, the red urine should keep the bears away, though, right? Theoretically,
right.
No? Yeah, I have an outdoor cat because he sprays when he comes in the house, so I feed him outside. So the raccoon helps herself to his
cool.
food. Cool. So.
Lois, that was the call of the day. Yeah. Thank you for that one. Now, fellas, do you find that a lot of these rodents will get UTIs?
I've never checked.
All right,
there's a grad project there somewhere.
Let's go to Lori in Burnt Hills. Lori, you're on.
There. Well, I might be in a dead zone right here, but what my question has to do with is raccoons also. And I am currently at a call for two raccoons that were abandoned and I'm a wildlife rehabilitator with my rabies vector species license. And there's not enough of us because of the state regulations that are so stringent that people that want to be wildlife rehabilitators for raccoons specifically can't.
All right. Well, we don't have much time left, but why don't you guys address that?
Sure. Lori, you're absolutely right. There are not enough wildlife rehabilitators, particularly those who are licensed to handle rabies vector species like bats or raccoons and skunks. And so even a meeting I was at last week, this came up and we were talking about potential solutions to help make it easier for other licensed rehabilitators to assist, to get licensed to handle rabies vector species and so forth. So we're looking at a variety of options. We're so grateful that you do what you do because you certainly provide a great service. Thinking back to the conversation that Fran asked earlier about solutions that don't involve killing wildlife, rehabilitators provide a really good service to New Yorkers by helping situations where we can both take either an orphan or injured animal and get them back up to health so that they can be released to the wildlife. So thanks for what you do.
Lori, thanks for the call. Quickly to Nassau, New York. Lara, you're on.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
So I have a question about something I saw walking down a road a couple of years ago. So I live in really rural southern Rensselaer County, and middle of the day, this cat comes walking down the road. For context, I have two 85-pound dogs. This was much larger than either of them, and it was kind of like a dark tan, like almost like dark tan, light brown color, but it did have a short tail. Its tail couldn't have been more than maybe 6 inches. And I was wondering if this is like some weird kind of bobcat, because it didn't look like any bobcat I had ever seen before.
Uh-huh. There's the mountain lion, fellas. Come on.
Doesn't sound like a mountain lion, but it sounds like you saw a bobcat. Probably a big one. I mean, it's always hard to kind of judge size on the fly, but yeah, short tail cat that's bigger than a house cat, you're probably looking at
Laura, a bobcat. Did you notice any coloring on its legs?
It was all just basically one color, basically like a dark tan, light brown all over. And its tail wasn't like nubby like a bobcat, but it definitely wasn't long like what you would see in a mountain lion.
Hmm.
Yeah, bobcat's probably the best guess just because there's not really any other wildlife that have short tails like that, cat-like wildlife or dog-like wildlife. But with bobcats, you often see some barring on the inside of the legs. So they're whiter on the inside with some black stripes or darker stripes. Sometimes bobcats don't all show that same degree of barring, but it's pretty common. And actually, we can detect individual bobcats from another, based on those barring patterns.
Huh. Well, there you go.
Huh. Okay.
Well, thanks a lot. Very quickly, Nancy writes in, last fall we had a large bobcat hanging out in Vischer Ferry Crescent area in our neighborhood. It was shocking how comfortable it was rambling around our backyard for a few weeks. Then it vanished. Is it unusual that they stay in populated areas for so long?
No. Right. I mean, bobcat live in our places, in our spaces, and so they're there for food, and enjoy it while you can see it.
Nancy also says they have a lot of coyotes, too, so there you go.
Yeah.
All right, Jeremy Hurst and Jordan Youngman, thanks for being on the show. Great job, fellas. Appreciate it. Support comes from Bittersweet Blackbird, Clifton Park, New York, a woman-owned and operated tattoo studio creating custom artistic designs tailored for each client, appointments only. BittersweetBlackbird.com. Ward's Nursery and Garden Center, Great Barrington, offering perennials for sun and shade, including deer-resistant and native choices. WardsNursery.com. And Daughters of Sarah, Albany, New York, providing a continuum of care for seniors, offering them opportunities to live at age gracefully with dignity and respect. DaughtersOfSarah.org. Thanks again to Jeremy Hurst and Jordan Youngman for being here today. Thank you for listening. Tons of calls, tons of emails. I'm sorry if we didn't get to yours. Jeremy will be back, and it's up to him if he's going to bring Jordan. But somebody will be back with Jeremy Hurst soon. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Mike Bowen, our engineer. Owen O'Leary screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's home maintenance and improvement with Darren Tracy. Break out your T-squares and your hammer. We'll see you, too.